dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of our comrades in arms in that war, at least in a figurative sense, of course, is Diana West. She graces this program each week, for which I'm very grateful. She is a longtime syndicated columnist, the author of three terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread, about the anti-Trump conspiracy and its ideological drivers. She can be found these days at dianawest.net and each week here. Diana, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful to be back.
Well, the President of the United States last night took to the hustings in a formal sense, announcing his candidacy to be reelected to a second term next November of 2020. Diana, the challenge for this president, obviously, is to some extent to invoke some of the themes that inspired his base and brought him to power in the end, but also to address some of the important changes that have taken place in the political sort of firmament, if you will, or ecosystem since he won office. You've studied this challenge of the anti-Trump conspiracy closely. How is it coloring the environment in which he will be running for office? And without unduly focusing on the politics of this, just the substantive challenges that the president is going to face to get a new mandate, as you see it.
Yes, well, it's a strategic challenge for him because, of course, the war that the left, the Democrats, the never-Trumpers, resistance, these factions that sought to overturn the election and destroy the presidency are hard at work and will be throughout the campaign cycle. And in his announcement speech, perhaps it was the right note to strike in terms of the echoing the truly splendid slogans of the 2016 election. However, there is going to have to be, in my view, a reckoning by the president in terms of making it understandable to the American people what he is up against, which is not just simply winning their vote again, but it is defeating this anti-democratic, and I would also add anti-American effort to subvert our systems, our surveillance powers, our police powers, etc., in order to stop the functioning, the working of the democratic system. Because, of course, the coup, the conspiracy against the president is not only against Donald Trump, it was against these, 62.3 million people who voted for him in order to stop democracy from working. And I think that is the crux of this. Big part of his electoral effort will be making that understandable to people.
Yeah, he hit that pretty hard last night, it seemed to me, and I think you're right. That's going to have to be part of his platform going forward, but also offering a new vision for the country that builds on what he has accomplished so far. And we'll be watching closely to see what he does in that regard. One of the things that he made much of in the previous election cycle, and that has been a very prominent feature of his presidency, of course, is the challenge that he has recognized uniquely, really, I think, for, well, probably five or six presidencies at least, posed by communist China. We had, however, the announcement yesterday that he will be meeting with Xi Jinping, the man who is now known as the president for life of the communist system there. He will doubtless, in the meeting coming up at the G20 summit later this month, focus a lot on the trade disputes. But Diana, there's so much more at work with respect to the Chinese Communist Party and its agenda that I'm anxious, I must say, that we'll find a preoccupation with the trade business let alone the prospect that we're going to have the president doing a deal with the Chinese Communist Party that will serve us poorly in the challenge that this rising power, this would-be world-straddling hegemon poses. You've studied closely, you know, communist totalitarian systems and their ideological apparatuses. Walk us through what the dangers might be here for doing a deal, even a good deal on trade with China, given everything else that is afoot there at the moment.
Well, the biggest pitfall, if that's a big enough word for it, is, of course, that communists lie. Communism is a system built on deception. And one of the most important aspects of this, I mean, I am protectionist as President Trump on this issue here. And what we're actually seeing happening here is a fascinating kind of formation of sides, maybe a recalibration as we move into this new election cycle, where we see the people who are so upset about President Trump's desire to do these fair trade agreements and to ensure that American companies and manufacturing are not destroyed by so-called free trade. We're starting to see those factions echoed in the rhetoric of Xi and, of course, Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Together, they have now come out as globalists. They have now come out as anti-protectionists, anti-whatever you want to call President Trump's desire for these fair trade agreements. We're seeing them as champions of so-called free markets, which actually fits perfectly with everything that I've been looking at in terms of understanding the so-called free trade globalist world as a way to advance the whole socialist internationalist system that, again, President Trump still to this day, with whatever faults, failings, disappointments, frustrations that we have in watching a mere mortal try to execute this gigantic job of his, he remains the sole threat to that system from completely extinguishing liberty around the world. So we're starting to see the left, the rhinos, the never Trump, the establishment, free traders now having their platform echoed by none other than Communist President Xi and perhaps stealth communist leader Putin. We're seeing the whole old communist system realign itself against Trump.
Yeah. Of course, it's a stretch to describe what they're actually up to, these globalists, as free trade. And that's part of the beef the president has with them. But they're seizing the rhetoric, as they're very good at doing, and confusing people about it or simply expropriating it. This is a hardy perennial of the left's techniques. You know, I'm looking at a document that appeared in oilprice.com that describes the Sino-Russian compact or master plan, it's called, to end American dominance in the Middle East. And this is just another example. We'll be talking more about this momentarily with Raymond Ibrahim, Diana West. But this is just another manifestation of a determination on the part of these two adversaries of the United States to work in concert against us. And I think, as you say, the extent that they're now wrapping themselves in the mantle of globalism, it's another reason to be very chary of that whole enterprise. Diana, we have to leave it at that for the moment. So much more to talk with you about. We'll look forward to doing so with you next week.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Raymond Ibrahim. He is a highly acclaimed author of several best-selling books, including most recently Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. We'll be talking in a moment as well about another of his books, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christianity. Raymond hails from Egypt originally. He is a Coptic Christian from that Middle Eastern country. He is a distinguished, as I say, author as well as commentator. And he is a Judith Friedman Rosen Writing Fellow at the Middle East Forum. It's so good to have you back, Raymond Ibrahim. Thank you for joining us.
Very good to be with you again, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Listen, I wanted to take advantage of your scholarship and personal familiarity with this phenomenon of jihad and the various forms it takes. We'll discuss several of them, but first, the threats that we are currently seeing manifested in the Persian Gulf from Iran are top of mind for a lot of us. It's the prospect of the violent kind of jihad. What do you make of the idea, Raymond, that we could actually negotiate away that danger as long as a regime like that of the Ayatollahs runs the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, the issue with Iran specifically, as opposed to other Islamic nations, is it's a Shia nation. And what's interesting about that is, you know, lots of us have heard and are familiar with the Islamic doctrine of taqiyya. And taqiyya is basically, it's grounded in the Quran, and the word comes from the Quran. Quran 328 is also used elsewhere, but it's been a codified doctrine that's all about dissembling, you know, hiding your belief, saying one thing, doing something else, et cetera, all to help empower Islam. Now, what's interesting is that even if you ask scholars, they will tell you that it is, they will say it is an absolute 100% Shia doctrine. The fact is, it's actually, it's also used with Sunnis, but the reason it was used with, or Shias have perfected it to an art, is because they, of course, were a Muslim minority amongst Sunnis, and Sunnis were persecuting them. So it's definitely been perfected into an art, and the point being that of all nations, Iran is probably the least that you can trust as far as it comes to what they say and what they're thinking and what they mean.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of folks of the Sunni persuasion insisting that taqiyya is a, you know, unique phenomenon to the Shia. But is that really the case? If it's in the Quran, is it not generally the view of what I call Sharia supremacists more generally, that they can lie when it advances the faith?
Yeah, absolutely. Taqiyya is just an Islamic doctrine. The Sunnis, of course, being the majority and being that they're the ones who persecuted smaller minorities, including Shias, are trying to scapegoat them and blame them for it. And what I'm trying to say ultimately is that it's true that the Shias have used it a lot more historically and have written about it and have codified it and taught it a lot more than the Sunnis. But now that the Sunnis are finding themselves in the Shias' position, namely as religious minorities in the West, so they too have adopted the approach of taqiyya, which is, you know, double speak. Giving an olive branch, but holding a dagger behind your back and so forth.
Let me ask you a particular case in point. Today, as it happens, you were supposed to be speaking at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and it didn't happen, apparently because of, well, some lies that were being spread about you by an organization known as the Council on American Islamic Relations, or by its acronym as CARE. Tell us what happened in this particular instance, Raymond Ibrahim, because it seems as though it's an example of another kind of, stealthy form of jihad.
Absolutely, Frank. So I was invited by the U.S. Army War College back in January to come give a lecture about my recent book, Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. And that was going to be the topic, the history, the military history between Islamic civilization and the West. And the U.S. Army War College was very enthusiastic, and they had all these advertisements of the event and so forth. CARE, on May 28th, the leadership of the Pennsylvania chapter, including Jacob Bender, send a formal letter basically protesting my appearance, saying, complaining about or saying how the Muslim community in Harrisburg surrounding the War College was very disappointed, to quote them, and shocked that they would invite a notorious Islamophobe, et cetera, et cetera. The War College at that point didn't even respond to their letter, but they made it a point to call me, and because it was reported in some media. So they called me and said, you know, don't worry about it. We're definitely on for sure. The next day, CARE just kicked it into high gear and just went into hysterical mode. CARE and also Linda Sarsour's group. It's called M-Power, I think M-Power Change. They sent out a petition. They sent out a press release. And what was and in these, what's amazing is they start describing me, who is of Egyptian descent, both parents from Egypt, as a racist, literally. They quote, they call me a racist, and they also associate me with the white nationalist movement. And there's a sentence there from the Linda Sarsour group in the petition basically saying that if the War College lets me speak before the military about history of all things, the soldiers are going to get so radicalized that they're going to go out in the streets and start shooting and killing Muslims in America. And unfortunately, at that point, the War College told me and also announced that the canceled, that, as you said, was scheduled for today, that the event that was scheduled for today, my event, was postponed. That's what the word they're using. And they're officially telling the media that it had nothing to do with CARE and the Linda Sarsour groups, even though, of course, it's been 6 months that I've scheduled this with them, and they canceled it 1 week before the day of the event today, and just about 1 or 2 days after CARE started their screed.
Yeah. So what do we know about this organization, Raymond Ibrahim, the Council on American-Islamic Relations? Yeah.
Well, it's got a long paper trail that associates it with unsavory characters and also terrorism. It's an unindicted co-conspirator of the largest terrorist funding case in U.S. history. And it's, you know, U.S. allies, think about it, the UAE, our close friend and ally, actually designates CARE as a terrorist group, not just the Muslim Brotherhood. CARE, by name, is a terrorist organization for countries like the UAE. And then, of course, all these other Arab nations who have the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. By extension, that goes to CARE, because CARE 100% is basically the propaganda mouthpiece of the Muslim Brotherhood. The FBI suspended all contact with CARE.
You mentioned that it was featured in the Holy Land Foundation trial, the largest terrorism financing trial in American history. In the course of that trial, as I recall, it actually was made known by the FBI, no less, that CARE was actually founded by Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood's Palestinian arm, which is a designated terrorist group. So there's a lot of reason to believe that these guys are very bad news. But this is a standard practice of theirs, isn't it, to silence people they consider to be challenging their victimhood narrative and otherwise complicating their influence operations on behalf of, well, Sharia supremacism, Raymond Ibrahim.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, the lecture was about history, and in their letter and in their petition and in their press releases, although they attack me personally, of course, they can't, you know, my book's 352 pages. They don't have one sentence from that book to show how I say something wrong or I misquote history, even though they insist on that. And the reason, of course, is because they can. And by the way, I had given the War College, I said, instead of canceling today's event, why don't you turn it into a debate? And actually, CARE can bring whichever historian they'd like to put against me. And they didn't want to go with that, because all they can do is just shut someone down from getting the truth out. They can't fight it. They can't, you know, undermine it.
Well, and the thing is that your book is such an incredibly rigorous historical examination of 14 of the major battles that have taken place throughout history, in which the same basic practice of violent jihad has been exercised by Muhammad and his successors. And interestingly, you've written a piece recently, Raymond, that caught my eye about how this cumulative experience has continued to shape the attitudes of people in Eastern Europe to the prospect of large numbers of Turks or Turk-enabled immigrants to come into their countries, much of which has actually now been shut down by Eastern Europe, as opposed to what's been generally going on in Western Europe. Just walk us through that history in microcosm, because it really speaks in a very powerful way about the larger phenomenon of jihad.
Right. Well, what Kerr is really worried about, that comes out very clearly in the book, and as you said, it's, you know, well documented over 1,000 endnotes and so forth, is that you see the behavior of groups like ISIS, which we are repeatedly told has nothing to do with Islam, the beheadings, the enslavement, church bombings, you know, enslavement of Jews and Christians and so forth. You see that going on for 1,000 years in you know, different ethnic manifestations. And so you see the Arab manifestation, the Berber manifestation, the Turkic manifestation, Persian manifestation, even the Tatar or Mongol manifestation against Russia specifically. And all of these groups, centuries worth of sultans and caliphs and emirs, speak just like ISIS and behave just like ISIS. And I think that's what they're trying so hard to suppress.
Raymond Ibrahim, there's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again soon for a longer visit. Next up, we'll speak with Claudia Rosette about the struggle for Hong Kong and whether we will stand with the people there against communist China. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by a friend of mine of many years, not to be confused with an old friend, needless to say, but of many years. Her name is Claudia Rosette. She is one of the country's truly preeminent and most highly regarded investigative journalists, much of her career having been spent with the Wall Street Journal as a reporter and an editorial writer. She is these days a blogger at PJ's Media's Rosette Report, and a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum. I'm reminded of the fact that back when Hong Kong was being surrendered by the British to the Chinese People's Republic in 1997, that Claudia and I had an opportunity to hang about a bit together, crying in our beer over what was likely to flow from that action. And here we are, all these years later, it's playing out in real time, notably on the streets of Hong Kong. Claudia Rosette, thank you so much for joining us to talk about all of that. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
So, Claudia, you had, by some counts, 2 million people of Hong Kong in the streets of the city peacefully demonstrating over the weekend, expressing their opposition to this law that is being foisted upon Hong Kong by the Chinese government. And it's playing out in a way that obviously wasn't what the PRC had in mind. Tell us what's gone on to date, and then we'll talk a little bit about what do you expect to come next.
Sure. Well, people in Hong Kong, reasonably enough, don't like the idea of a law that would allow them to be extradited to, among other places, China, the mainland China. You know, Frank, back when I was working in Hong Kong for the Wall Street Journal, this was in the colonial days, 1986 to 93, before the British handover of 97. Hong Kong is a special autonomous region to China with the promise of 50 years of one country, two systems. People would come through Hong Kong and they would ask, so how bad is this handover likely to be? And I had a simple answer. I would say, if they were foreigners, Americans, give me your passport. And they would give me their passport. I would throw it in the trash. And I would say, okay, how, you know, you tell me, how bad will this be? You're now, you can't go somewhere else. You live in Hong Kong. You're a citizen of what is going to be the special autonomous region of China. And that's exactly the problem, is they know in Hong Kong just how dangerous this would be. It would be the beginning of a real reign of fear. Because if China has the ability to just to say, we think so-and-so has committed a crime. Remember, the definition of a crime in China is rather different from the definition in the free world. China is a country where their Nobel Peace Laureate, Liu Xiaobo, was repeatedly sentenced to prison for advocating an end to one-party rule in China, you know, pluralism in politics, and died of cancer while serving an 11-year sentence 2 years ago. That's what goes on in China. And people in Hong Kong know this. And Hong Kong is essentially, in so many ways, was really prepared to become a free, independent country when the British left. You know, if you look back at the history of that time, it was the post-colonial era. All these former colonies were being given independence, except Hong Kong, which was handed to China. And these were people, these are people, I mean, I don't think anybody anywhere should be handed to the jurisdiction of China. The people in China have, should be free of that problem. But for Hong Kong in particular, although Hong Kong as a British Crown colony was not a democracy, it was backed, it was ruled by a British governor with a legislature that didn't have a lot of power, basically. But the British, it was backed by British parliamentary democracy. It was backed by the British system of law. It was backed by institutions, in other words, of the free world. And that's what people in Hong Kong have grown up with, are used to, understand. Even people born after the handover have been living under, and this is really important, a system that's basically British law.
The rule of law. Specifically.
Exactly, which is vital for capitalism, which is vital for any system to really function well. And, you know, Hong Kong is one of the world's most marvelous cities to this day, including the fact that these people turned out in the street to stand up for their freedom. That's what this is about.
Do you credit, Claudia, the estimates that there were a million some last week and 2 million over the weekend? The authorities are given to say that it was, oh, a couple hundred thousand, but by other estimates, it's, you know, a fourth of the population was actually demonstrating. Could that be credible?
No, again, I'm not actually there. I wish I were right now, Frank. But having looked at the video, listened to people, talked with people I know there and so on, yes, I certainly can. And I think what happened is it's important to understand that it is an act of real courage for someone to come out and be seen demonstrating in Hong Kong because China is watching. It is truly the surveillance state. And there are cameras all over Hong Kong as well. You know, the British have them too. It's virtually impossible to move there without being on camera somewhere. And China keeps records. China keeps tracks. China will have its revenge. So for people to go out and demonstrate now is to take a real risk. And I think what happened is people are genuinely alarmed. The idea that you could be extradited to China, imagine if that came to your town, how terrifying that could be. And on the Sunday, a week ago Sunday, the million-person march, give or take, were people who just said, I've got to do this, I'm going to take the risk. I think that the one of the things that happens with protests of this kind is there's a greater a sense of safety in numbers. People who saw that that march took place and then saw that this bill was delayed, I felt it was probably a little safer to turn out, and they did, to express themselves. Whether it was exactly 2 million, I don't know, but it was enormous. I know those streets, Frank.
I know you do. I know you do. So, Claudia Rosette, are they safer, in fact, or is this just a stay of execution that the Chinese are likely to, you know, bring to an end with a show of violent force rather than risk not only further slippage in their control of Hong Kong, but perhaps allow the example of people getting away with resisting China to metastasize inside the mainland itself?
It's a stay of execution, at best. That's one of my great concerns. The only thing that's going to really make this stick would be a real change in the character of the regime in Beijing, which is devoutly to be wished. That would be better for the world. But unless that happens, Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party probably will calculate that they cannot afford to let people of Hong Kong defy them this way. And I wouldn't rule out anything. It's possible that they will make the calculation that force is a lesson that will finally end this headache for them. It's also possible that they will send an army of auditors to make miserable behind the scenes, you know, in some financial way, anyone seen to be backing these protests. There are a lot of ways they've already been using to undermine Hong Kong's liberties. They could greatly step those up. And again, I wouldn't rule out use of force either, because they also in Beijing, remember, if this is the level of Hong Kong's resistance to the idea of being extradited to China, ask yourself what you'd see if people in China were truly free to speak up about how they feel living under this jurisdiction of China.
So, Claudia, let me just ask you, because, you know, the question ultimately comes down to this. It is in the vital interests of the United States, it seems to me, that we stand with the people of Hong Kong and discourage China from ending this stay of execution, especially, you know, brutally and violently. This is taking place against the backdrop of a possible meeting between President Trump and Xi Jinping. We've talked yesterday with Gordon Chang about some evidence that the president is prepared to relent on some of the steps he's taken vis-a-vis Huawei. There's pressure building for him to abandon his use of tariffs to try to extract important structural changes in the trade relations with the Chinese. It would seem as though all of those are ill-advised, it seems to me, on a good day, but this would be a very bad time to be signaling such concessions, let alone avoiding the opportunity that we have, as I understand it, to impact dramatically Chinese calculations by threatening to rescind the most favored nation status that it basically benefits from having accorded to an autonomous Hong Kong. If, as now seems obvious, it is no longer really autonomous.
Two basic points here. One is Hong Kong is one of ours. Okay, it may be officially China's turf as a special autonomous region, but the treaty, the Sino-British Treaty of 1984, the Joint Declaration, spelled out that for 50 years after the handover, until the year 2047, Hong Kong was to have a high degree of autonomy. It was to remain part of the free world, basically, until that horrible deadline. But that's now still 28 years off. So if we let China go ahead and steamroll over Hong Kong way before that deadline, which the whole thing should never have been set up this way, but it shouldn't have been handed over at all to my mind, but given that it was, then we are signaling to China that's a concession that you can simply take part of the free world and swallow it. That is an invitation to terrible things, and I would worry greatly that the next step would be Taiwan. That's point one. Second, as far as what can we do, on trade, I think anything where we're giving China strategic advantages, we should be saying no. We should not be doing anything that transfers technology. On trying to actually shut down trade in some way that damages China greatly, I think that's very hard to do. They're very good at getting around it. You'll be buying things that say made in a country in Southeast Asia. They'll be coming from China. They switch the labels.
Claudia Rosette, thank you for your time today, as well as the great work that you do, Claudia, at the Independent Women's Forum, and of course at PJ Media. Come back to us again soon. We'll be following this story closely, as I know will you, and I look forward to discussing with you in the days ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Michael Cutler. He is a retired senior special agent in the Immigration and Naturalization Services. He is a very active contributor to the public policy debate, particularly about matters involving immigration and border security and the like, notably through his essays at frontpagemagazine.com and his own radio show, The Michael Cutler Hour, which is heard Friday evenings on Blog Talk Radio. You can also follow him at michaelcutler.net. Michael, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Always great to join you, Frank. Thanks so much for having me on.
Glad to have you. Thank you. There's a lot to talk about. Notably, I'd like to start, I think, with the president's statement the other day, or tweet, I guess it was, that he was going to order the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Organization, known as ICE, to begin rounding up and deporting, quote, millions of illegal aliens in this country. And I'd be interested in your take on that. Is there any evidence that that is, in fact, in the offing? Could he do it? And should he?
He absolutely should. I've always argued that interior enforcement is at least as important as border enforcement because, we're a country of 50 border states and you have aliens who become subject to deportation when they commit crimes and so forth, even if they were legally admitted into the country. We lack the resources at ICE. A big problem, I've called this failure by design, where the immigration service is concerned, because corporations want the cheap labor, lawyers want the immigration clients, and the Chamber of Commerce wants all the above. But he does have ICE agents, and there's something that can be done that I've argued should be done. I was part of the drug task force for half of my 30-year career with the INS. So I worked with the DEA, FBI, and other agencies to enforce immigration laws and take down major narcotics trafficking organizations. There's no reason not to be able to detail agents from other agencies to work with ICE to be able to get the job done that the president wants done. And there's at least about a million illegal aliens who have already been ordered deported. They've appealed their orders of deportation, and they're still out there. So this is low-hanging fruit. When you get your hands on somebody like that, they're getting on an airplane. Whether they like it or not, they're subject to removal because they have no appeals left. So they could start with that million. But I think it also sends a very clear message of deterrence. Up until now, look at what's happened. New York State giving driver's licenses to illegal aliens, which violates the findings of the 9/11 Commission, is very dangerous and creates more incentive. Sanctuary cities promised to harbor and shield illegal aliens from detection by ICE, which is nuts. And by the way, Governor Cuomo in New York is worrying that they've got to be careful how they create licenses for illegal aliens to make certain that under no circumstances ICE can't have access to the records. What he really should be getting is the MVP award from ISIS, because interior enforcement was, for the 9/11 Commission, a critical issue. And I provided testimony to the commission. I've arrested terrorists. So why you would want to shield people who trespassed on America or are convicted felons blows my mind. But this is all what's on one side of the equation. Donald Trump comes along and says, okay, you may get a driver's license, but you can put that license in your pocket when we put you on that airplane and send you out of the country.
Yeah. Let me ask you, this raises the larger question about the cooperation that should be provided to ICE by local law enforcement organizations. You've noted in a recent piece, Michael Cutler, that this is particularly important in dealing with the threat posed by very dangerous gangs like MS-13. But it doesn't stop there. And what's happening on that front? Is it possible to generalize nationwide?
Yeah, absolutely. People are dying. I mean, that's the headline. People are dying every single day. Everybody knew about Kate Steinle. The news media is into sensationalism. So when the girl that is killed is young and gorgeous, everybody gets excited. People are people are people. Whether you're beautiful or not, your life is equally valuable. The article that I wrote for Front Page Magazine was "Politicians Must Face Consequences for the Crimes That They Enable." The subtitle was "Malfeasant Politicians Must Find No Quote-Unquote Sanctuary." So the case in point that prompted me to write that commentary, if you remember that horrific Parkland shooting in Florida where I believe 17 people, most children, were shot to death in a mass shooting, the sheriff's deputy, who has now been arrested, has been charged with not acting to protect the lives of the children that he was responsible to protect. And I'm not going to delve into the merits of that case. It's an ongoing prosecution, and there's all sorts of factors involved. But I want everyone to just stop and think about it. The sheriff's deputy failed to act in the judgment of prosecutors. He's been arrested, charged with 7 felonies and 4 misdemeanors. He could spend an awful lot of time in jail. Now you've got politicians ordering agents to not act in concert with ICE. Case in point, Prince George's County in Maryland, 2 members of MS-13, alleged members, were arrested. They were charged with attempted murder in the first degree, conspiracy to commit murder, robbery, and other crimes. ICE came in, lodged a detainer that said, if you release them, let us know. We want to get our hands on them. I used to lodge detainers as a matter of routine. And guess what? They were released. And the argument first was, well, we didn't know. We had no idea. Then they changed their story, the people at Prince George's County, And the argument was, well, they weren't charged with serious crimes. Attempted murder? Conspiracy to commit murder?
Yeah, pretty serious stuff. So you're saying that these people, these politicians, basically, should be held to the same standard
as that sheriff's deputy. They both took similar oaths of office, and a girl is dead. How are they not accountable for the death of a 14-year-old girl who was beaten to death and stabbed to death?
It seems like a very important point, Michael Cutler. Hey, let me switch gears quickly to another topic, Michael, just to do a sort of sanity check here. There are a lot of people who are carping that President Trump didn't get much from the Mexicans after he threatened to impose tariffs on their goods. I've had guests on the program who disagree with that assessment. Where do you come down on it, Michael?
Oh, I disagree vehemently. Look, I just find it amazing. There's this Trump derangement syndrome that we hear about, and that's an example of it. This is the first time that Mexico has really agreed to cooperate with America because he has put their feet to the fire. He's doing the same thing with China, by the way. He's looking at things not from this obsequious, well, how do we make nice to everybody and make the Chamber of Commerce happy? Because the Chamber of Commerce is the most anti-American organization the side of the Communist Party. They are our enemy. And up until now, you've had one administration after another placating the Chamber of Commerce. You have Trump come along and say, wait a minute, we can't have millions of people entering the country illegally, burdening our systems. And by the way, when you bring people into the country, it's not just finding a house for them or a job, and jobs are still more people than jobs. It's the ecological footprint. You know, they need water and food and sewerage and electricity, and they use the buses and subways. We're overwhelming all of our systems. And the people that are coming in are people that we can't even vet properly. They're basically trespassing. And he said, we've got to have to take an action here. And the action that he took was to apply extreme pressure to Mexico. And I read an interesting article. The president of Mexico was thinking about selling his official airplane to raise the money to accomplish the goals to keep Trump from taking that action with the tariffs. When have we ever heard of any country reacting that quickly? Remember, when he said tariffs, within 2 days, the Mexicans didn't walk, but they ran to the White House. This is an unprecedented achievement. Whether you like Trump or you don't, and I have issues with him, his use of language, my degree was communications, arts, and sciences. His use of language upsets me sometimes, but his goals are worthwhile. And if we could get Mexico to live up to their responsibilities of literally being a good neighbor, this would go a long distance. And by the way, the people that say, well, Mexico isn't going to pay for the wall. If we could stop the flood of money being sent home by illegal aliens from Mexico, if we could put a dent in the narcotics trade, we're talking billions and billions of dollars every year. The money sent home to Mexico by their workers is their second biggest form of national income. If we can put a dent in it, believe me, the wall pays for itself. You know, I compare the wall to insulation in the house. If you can keep the heat in the house during the wintertime, your heating bill goes down, the insulation pays for itself. So I think what he's doing with Mexico is exactly right.
Michael Cutler, so much more to talk with you about that and other things. Come back to us again very soon, if you will. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.